Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and tech that's entertaining and accessible. If we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with my co-host John Wells. Today in the program, we'll speak with Narina Sadasivan. I've been practicing that all morning. She's a reporter at ProPublica. It describes itself as an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. She's recently written an investigative piece on the emerging health aspects of fracking. The science has lagged behind on this topic, but she'll give her synthesis of the science.
Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, John.
Our second guest will be Karen Wilkinson, co-author of The Art of Tinkering. This is the authoritative book on creatively applied tinkering, taking things apart, exploring tools and material, art, science, technology, all mixed up together in these wild and beautiful projects, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We will be back after these messages and also today's cool story.
Who's been underground all these years, waiting to take over? Who's been helping them? And who is going about their Park City lives, blissfully unaware of the corporate tentacles gripping the town? In Epic Follies comes the Egyptian Theater April 4th, 5th, and 6th, and April 9th through 12th. The Park City Follies is a lighthearted look at local issues on what's going on in town. Buy tickets online at parkcityshows.com. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization, and Epic Follies, always a good time.
10 gorgeous dancers, one night of extraordinary contemporary performance. Trey McIntyre Project dances into the Eccles Center spotlight Saturday, March 29th. Adventurous and unpredictable, says the Chicago Tribune. Trey McIntyre and his dancers deliver a powerful performance. Show starts at 7:30. Tickets start at $20. Call the Always On Their Toes staff at 655-3114. Brought to you by the not-for-profit Park City Institute, educating, illuminating, and entertaining since 1998.
Here's a question for you. Would you rather hear your new baby's first cries in the hospital or in the backseat of your car on the way to Salt Lake? Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, where we have a dedicated maternity staff and state-of-the-art labor and delivery unit just minutes from anywhere in town. Park City Medical Center. Because when you're in labor, a short drive to the hospital can be the difference between your doctor delivering your baby or your spouse doing it. Park City Medical Center is a nonprofit community hospital and part of the Intermountain Healthcare family.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with John Wells. Well, what is the science behind fracking? For years, environmentalists and the gas drilling industry have been pitched in a pitch battle over the possible health implications of fracking. But to a great extent, the debate has been hampered by a shortage of science. And our first guest, Narina Sadasivan, has written an investigative piece compiling and condensing some of the science that has so far been published on the health aspects of fracking. She's now joining us by phone. Good morning to you, Narina.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. First of all, wanted to ask you a few questions about ProPublica. So it's an online news source. It describes itself as an investigative reporting entity. Can you tell us a little bit about, I know that you have recently begun there as a journalist and you have a background from an impressive journalism school, but you're actually working as an intern now. Talk a little bit about ProPublica and what it does, because from what our understanding, it's supposed to be quite a balanced investigative journalism entity.
Right, sure. So ProPublica was created a few years ago, about 5 years ago, because, you know, there was a real lack of investigative journalism. And what we do here is we focus on government accountability issues and investigative news. So we take our time with stories. We really go after sources and try to condense information that is actually useful to the public. So we've done stories from 2008 on fracking, really before a lot of other news media outlets picked up on the issue of fracking and the several environmental and public health concerns. And we've also done different stories on dark money, patient harm and safety, and other issues of public concern.
Okay, so your editor, Paul Steiger, or Steiger, is the former managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. This gives him, I would say, quite a bit of credibility. And then there's also the entities, ProPublica's founders, that have been looked at as maybe more left-leaning. Do you feel that it's pretty well-balanced, or what are some of the, I mean, the entity is a Pulitzer Prize winner, but what's your take on it?
You know, I joined about 2 months ago, and my sense has been that reporters here are given a lot of time, which many other institutions don't have, to really look into some of the stories that we're doing and really spend time and effort trying to collect and curate information that's useful to the public. So in that sense, I feel that ProPublica is ahead of several other institutions. The concern now with online journalism is that it needs to be quick, it needs to be fast, and we need to get a lot of clicks, but our focus really isn't that at all. So we're really looking at things that are useful to the public that will make a difference.
So, Navina, let's talk about fracking.
Sure.
Could you give us an update on the spread of fracking, how many states, how many wells, what the plans are for the future? I really don't know what the current situation is. We saw the debut of Gasland, the documentary, here at Sundance a couple of years ago. But I really don't have an update on how far this has spread.
Sure. So fracking, the technology itself, has been around for a really long time, since the 1940s or so. But the real boom, the gas boom, took place in the early 2000s, and it became to the national consciousness around 2008 and 2009, and it became a conversation topic around that time. And at the moment, about 40% of all natural gas that is being produced in the United States is from shale formations. So they are extracted using fracking. And there are around maybe 20 or so states in the country that have significant fracking operations. And some of the hot spots really are Pennsylvania, for instance, which overlies the Marcellus Formation, Ohio as well, right next door, on top of the Marcellus Formation. And in Texas, for instance, you have the Barnett and Eagle Ford Shale, North Dakota, Colorado, New Mexico. These are some of the real hot spots for fracking at the moment. And my sense is that the fracking really isn't going to slow down for the next couple of years. Natural gas prices have dropped, but operators are trying to export some of the gas, and it seems like I don't have hard numbers, but it seems like fracking is in our future, at least for the next 5 to 10 years.
Sure, and chemicals used in fracking and drilling have remained secret. I mean, some of those have been released, but many of those have not. How can toxicologists and doctors and regulators, how can they render opinions on if this is good for us or not if they don't know what they're dealing with?
Yeah, that's definitely a big issue. Chemical disclosure is a difficult topic with fracking. Doctors and researchers do have some sense of the kinds of chemicals that are in fracking fluids and are being used in fracking operations, but we don't have a comprehensive list of those chemicals. And that's really because of what is now called as the Halliburton loophole. In 2005, when an energy policy was being written, the then Vice President Dick Cheney, who was also a former CEO at Halliburton, wrote in certain exemptions for the fracking industry, and that's really why, on a federal level, they haven't been required to disclose chemicals. But that is slowly changing because states are now introducing laws for chemical disclosures. seen certain laws come out in Wyoming, Pennsylvania, Texas. And so doctors and researchers have some sense. They have a partial list of those chemicals, but they don't have, you know, a comprehensive list. And that's definitely a difficulty for them.
Hmm. It makes me first think on how that would be the one instance in which Utah would turn over control to the federal government rather than how Utah typically wants to have state control over many things. Interesting that the states of New York and Maryland have really, as you say in your article, responded to the public's insistence on public health, and they have a moratorium on fracking. Talk about that and why public insistence has really turned the tide in those states.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, New York and Maryland, you're right, they do have a moratorium in place, and fracking is not allowed there at the moment. And it's really because of activists, environmentalists, you know, contacting their state regulators and really opposing allowing fracking on their lands. And there's a lot of environmental and public concerns surrounding that. So, for instance, now in New York, the governor, Andrew Cuomo, has asked the health commissioner to look into public health issues surrounding fracking. And he says that he will not decide about whether or not to lift the current ban until Nirav Shah, the health commissioner, comes back with a report and explains his findings. So things are still being decided in New York and Maryland.
Well, this makes me wonder how public health concerns can be ascertained if scientists and researchers aren't even allowed into the world of fracking.
It's definitely one of the several difficulties that researchers are facing. One concern from researchers is that they're not being allowed access onto well pads. You know, the industry isn't very welcoming, and that's a concern that I've heard from some scientists. So how are they supposed to get accurate emission levels and data if they can't, you know, actually go onto the well pad and get some of that information? So what they do is they make compromises. They set up air emission testing stations nearby, you know, downwind of where the operations are actually taking place, and they try to capture some of those emissions. So, yeah, some of the science has been hampered because the industry hasn't been very cooperative.
And besides the fact that the industry is not cooperative, do you believe the EPA is actively working to be advocates for all of us, or do you think that they're just going along for the ride?
That's a difficult question to answer. The EPA has taken some steps. They're conducting a comprehensive study on groundwater effects from hydraulic fracturing and the chemicals that are used in the process. And the EPA also proposed new emission standards for air quality in 2012, and those rules are slowly being phased in. So what it requires operators to do now is use green completion systems, which means that any emission that is coming out of their operations needs to be captured. It can't just be vented into the air, and that's slowly being phased in. The deadline for operators to comply to those rules is 2015. And some companies had been voluntarily doing that because some of these emissions contain methane, and it's a main component of natural gas. So capturing it makes financial and business sense for them as well.
Are you talking about the wastewater that is pulled from the well?
Not just the wastewater. So, for instance, when you drill a well and you start producing gas, sometimes that gas comes out at a very high pressure, and the system, the equipment, isn't able to handle that pressure. And so some of the gas is just vented into the air till the gas begins to flow at a reasonable pressure. So, those emissions need to be collected.
Yeah. Preparing for our conversation this morning, I was talking with Chris Cherniak, who's our environmental He's an environmental engineer, but he's also the host of This Green Earth, another program here at KPCW. And basically, he was telling me that the wastewater, that 3 to 4 million gallons is pulled from each well and stored in a lined pond on site. And the gist of, you know, rather than going into all the details and all the different chemicals that they've discovered so far, is that this wastewater can gas off while it's sitting, and it can be sitting indefinitely, that contributes to air quality and health issue problems around the well. I wasn't really aware of that before. Is that significant as far as the health challenges?
No, absolutely. That's another issue too. They're using millions of gallons of water mixed with chemicals to frack a well, and so once they're done fracking, those chemicals, that contaminated water is then stored in these large pits. And the problem with these chemicals is that they don't all stay in liquid form. They volatilize and they go off into the air, and then, you know, the wind carries it downstream to some houses or businesses or schools nearby, and it has affected air quality. Another issue with the wastewater, of course, is that some of these pits are lined, but sometimes they leak, and so they contaminate groundwater. So, yeah, definitely wastewater is a major issue, mainly because just of the bulk quantity in which it's being produced.
So do you believe that the contamination of the groundwater is happening more from above, from these leaks that may happen in the holding ponds, or from below?
I don't think I have a good answer for that, because I haven't really looked at research, and I don't think there's research that compares, groundwater contamination from pits versus while fracking. But I know that definitely there are concerns about well fracking itself and chemicals leaking into the groundwater while they're fracking. So generally they're supposed to have a concrete lining while drilling, and sometimes that concrete isn't, it cracks or it has openings, and so the chemicals are able to leak into groundwater. So there are many ways in which these chemicals are reaching water sources.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about downwind. In your article, you talk about Garfield County, Colorado. Now, that's downwind from northeast Utah, and you didn't mention Utah as one of the big states that where fracking takes place, but out in our northeast corner in Duchesne County, fracking is one of the biggest industries, and downwind is Colorado, and also with all the fracking going on in Colorado, this has really been pointed as the area of study for health concerns. Is that right?
Right. Garfield County has been a place for a number of studies, mainly because the Colorado Public School of Health has been looking into the issue, and they've been producing a lot of research surrounding fracking there.
Okay. And you talk specifically about, and actually, I don't know if this study was done in Garfield County, but I believe so. It was a highly publicized case where a lifelong gag order was imposed on two children, this having to do with some of the unsafe chemicals and the health concerns. Talk about that.
Sure. So that case, I believe, was in Pennsylvania, and a family had several health issues and concerns, and they sued one of the companies that they believed was the cause for all of their concerns. And the court ended up issuing a lifelong gag order, and that was part of the agreement that none of the family members would talk about their issues or talk about the settlement or any of the details surrounding the case once they signed the agreement. And two young children were also included in that, which was a little strange. But gag orders are pretty common in the gas industry, dealing with residents who have different groundwater or public health concerns. And it makes it difficult to really understand what the full extent of fracking is on communities, because several of these people are limited by these gag orders and are not able to fully explain their cases.
Navina, the National Association of Pediatric Doctors has also gotten together and issued statements on health concerns for children. Is there anything that is coming from their recommendations?
You know, I haven't specifically looked at their recommendations, but I have heard from several families who complain that their children have nosebleeds when they're out playing, and there are specific odors or emissions from nearby well pads, and there are concerns. There is one study that I mentioned in my article, which looked at birth defects for mothers who lived close to some of these well pads, and then the study concluded that there was a higher rate of congenital heart defects and other birth defects for mothers who lived in communities that had a lot of fracking going on.
Besides Governor Cuomo, who with his ban or moratorium in New York State and possibly the EPA, is there anybody else that's acting as advocates for our kids? Who's advocating for our children? It seems like I've read a number of articles where people are saying either nothing's going on the health concern side, on the health side, or we need to have further study. Kind of reminds me of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, you know, I spoke with one researcher, and I thought he put it very well. He said that science and researchers will always want more data. They will always want more information and more concrete proof. It's up to society to decide when enough is enough and when they feel that the risk from fracking is too much and, you know, what regulations they want for their society. So that I thought was an interesting way to look at this whole issue, because definitely the industry has always been saying that the science is not in, so it makes no sense to have regulations when the science isn't completely conclusive yet. But it's up to society, I feel.
Well, if some of those people had their own children that were sick, what would they change their tune? I mean, of course they would. I guess I would feel better if somebody would just come through the front door and say, "We're the EPA or we're the whatever organization, and our position is we really don't care. And we're just going to support fracking because it's good for the United States. It's good for business." I would just prefer that someone just come through the front door and be honest.
Yeah, we haven't seen that, and we haven't seen any organization step up and say we need to really look at public health and assess what's happening. That kind of large systematic look, and researchers want that too. They want to have a large study over several years that has enough data points and conclusively prove it. But, you know, the funding is scarce for that, and we haven't seen any major organization step up and take that position.
Right. Now, large studies and research efforts that are being hampered by those in the drilling industry, right. You know, they make that a little impossible. But also, are vital anecdotes of health assessment being dismissed and overlooked for the same reason? I mean, are there, because there aren't these huge studies done, then we have to sort of look at anecdotal evidence, but are those being dismissed across the board?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the industry has been dismissing anecdotal evidence, but that doesn't mean that scientists and researchers have also been dismissing them. There have been studies that have collected survey information from communities like Washington County in Pennsylvania and other counties where fracking is really extensive. So there has been an effort to understand how the community feels. There was one study, for instance, that looked at stress levels over time for residents in Pennsylvania. I forget the exact county. But it did find that over time, stress levels were going up, and people were definitely attributing it to all the fracking that was happening around them. So even if, you know, and this is not the case, but even if we were to say that there are absolutely no direct health effects from fracking, people are still concerned, and there is, mm-hmm. Mental issues that are happening here.
I know that I can be opinionated, and I just want to clarify my position. I am not mm-hmm. anti-fracking. I am just somebody my opinion is that we just need to open things up and that we need to be honest about things and due diligence and do these studies. And if you have the National Association of Pediatric Doctors saying that this is a health risk for our children, if we have children that are under – whose parents are under gag orders, I mean, we just need to have – no, we don't need further study. We just need to get this thing going, find out what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I was a parent, then I would definitely agree with you, and I do. You have a lot of political parties and influencers in this game here, so it's not as straightforward as that, unfortunately.
Right. Well, Navina Sadasivam, thank you so much for joining us today. Our guest is a journalist for ProPublica, an online publication of investigative journalists. And thank you so much for your time and best of continued luck in your efforts.
Thank you,
Navina. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, before we go to underwriters, we want to mention that it is snowing pretty heavily and we have a couple of accidents out there. We have an accident at the intersection of I-80 and 40. We have traffic moving slowly on – well, actually, 40 was backed up in standstill, but it's moving slowly now. But heavy snow, low visibility, and slushy, slick road. These are calls in from listeners. And we have a – let's see what else we have here. Bum, 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 bum. Just very slow coming into Park City. So we will continue to give you updates on the traffic as we get them.
Very good. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Karen Wilkinson. She's the co-author of the book, The Art of Tinkering, and this is a wild, wonderful book. We'll talk all about creativity and tinkering when we return.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly starting at 5:30, also serving Sunday brunch from 9 to 1. The website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. What happens when the creative mind tinkers? Well, tinkering's taking things apart, exploring tools, materials, building wondrous, wild art that's part science, part technology. The Art of Tinkering doesn't tell you how to do or make things, but it inspires you to become a tinkerer. In the book, The Art of Tinkering, there's a quote that reads, "The bliss of tinkering isn't just for artists or engineers. It's a way that we can all be more human." And here to tell us about being more human through tinkering is co-author of the book, Karen Wilkinson. Karen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
We actually don't have Karen on the line just yet. I think our phones have been tied up with people calling in with weather reports. So we'll go to an underwriting break for just a moment, and hopefully we'll be right back with Karen Wilkinson.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
KPCW presents Behind the Gold, a look back at Olympic history hosted by Tom Kelly. These stories are weekly on Mondays and Fridays, brought to you in part by Rosenberg, Cooley, and Metcalf Clinic at the Park City Medical Center and the Utah Olympic Park.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We are still waiting to get Karen Wilkinson on the phone to talk about her book, The Art of Tinkering. So we're just going to change the schedule around a little bit and do today's cool story. Oh, two, maybe 3 months ago, we were speaking with an author who told us, among other things, about Big Blue, the IBM computer that is so famous for taking on human contestants in the game show Jeopardy, and also in defeating Garry Kasparov, the chess master. Now Big Blue is being redeployed to battle cancer one by one.
It's really interesting, and a lot of this has to do with the sort of recent discoveries and innovations and advancements in sequencing the genome. And so the genome can be, the genome of the tumor can be sequenced, and that helps oncologists determine exactly what needs to happen in terms of targeting that specific tumor. It's fascinating.
So we used to look at a type of cancer like lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, and we used to just go after it.
With the protocol.
Right. And now we have something which is finely tuned, as you said, using the genome, that they can identify the mutation of the cancer cells for that particular patient and then target some sort of therapy. And I believe that Big Blue is being used to work on brain cancer.
Ah, right. And, you know, the problem is that many mutations in a cancer cell may be harmless, and targeting them will be a waste of time. And as we know, giving all of those chemo drugs and even radiation can have lasting harmful effects for the patient. And so just targeting this specific one is going to be probably one of the biggest advancements we've seen in cancer treatment and research and treatment recently. Fascinating.
Yeah, I'm reading about what other things Big Blue has been up to, but Big Blue has been doing a lot of medical work in the last 10 years or so.
Go Big Blue! Yeah, and that's not a sports team. I wouldn't even be able to come up with a sports team that's blue. You would, though.
I think so.
I'll stick with Big Blue, the supercomputer.
Well, I believe our guest is on the phone, Karen Wilkinson, and I'll start the introduction again. What happens when the creative mind tinkers? Well, tinkering is taking stuff apart, exploring tools, materials, building wondrous wild art that's part science, part technology. In the book, The Art of Tinkering doesn't tell you how to do or make these things, but it inspires you to become a tinkerer. We have with us Karen Wilkinson, who is co-author of the book. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So tell us how you got involved in tinkering, and tell us about your operation in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, I think I've been a tinkerer from birth, but I happened to land in a wonderful place at the Exploratorium here in San Francisco and run a space within the museum called the Tinkering Studio, where we bring folks in and give them opportunities to tinker.
Yeah, exactly. This is kind of like the artist collectives of the 60s and the 70s, where tinkerers and hacker spaces are springing up everywhere.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's definitely in the zeitgeist. I think it's something that's gaining momentum.
Lynn and I were down at the Leonardo, which is a museum here in Salt Lake City. We're down looking at, we're doing an interview for the Salt Lake for the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I found out recently they have a little tinkering studio actually there at the museum. So I've got to check that out and see what all of you are up to.
Yeah, they've actually, right before the Leonardo opened, they came out for some workshops here at the Exploratorium. So we're tinkerers in conspiracy together.
I like that. And I like that you use the word zeitgeist to kind of describe how it's a little bit of a movement. But let's go back. I found some interesting literature somewhere on your website that talks about the origins of tinkering and where the word comes from.
Well, the word is really interesting. We've been doing a lot of workshops now, actually around the world. We're getting ready to go to Russia next month. Tinkering is not a word that's universal, but it's been very interesting for people to describe what the word in their different language means.
Right.
But it to us, it's really about trying to kind of follow your path through something, a little part problem solving, part problem posing, and a lot of ingenuity.
Mm. And what you say is that it's more, tinkering is more a perspective and a curiosity than it is a vocation, even though in the English language, at least, it came from the 1300s and the tinsmiths.
Yes.
That's where the actual origin of the word is, which I found fascinating.
Yes, my favorite part. Well, speaking of the tinsmith, in Willy Wonka, there's a person right. who walks by and is referred to as a tinkerer, and he's got pots and pans kind of hanging off his cart. But anyway, yes, with the origins of it, I think it was probably that kind of gadgety fix-it repair, and that's certainly part of kind of this larger maker movement. But I think it's this ability to kind of cultivate curiosity and get yourself through things, you know, as you kind of come up against frustration or failure, trying things out. And, well, for us, it's really conversing almost with phenomena, whether it's science or technology or art.
When I was a kid growing up in New York, my father traveled all the time, and I think that's the only way I was able to get away with this, but slowly appliances would disappear from the kitchen, and they'd end up on my father's workbench, and I'd start taking stuff apart. And also I would do things that probably weren't really bright, like sticking tweezers in wall sockets and things to see what electricity was all about. And so I wasn't very good at putting things back together. But I was really good at taking things apart. But this whole thing fascinates me in that it's such a growing movement.
Yeah, taking things apart is a wonderful way to start. And, you know, there is inherent risk, like you mentioned, the tweezers in the socket. That'll get your attention for sure.
Oh, boy.
One of the things that we really encourage people to do is find something that's battery-operated and take it apart as your first attempt at dissection. We love toys, actually, because it's amazing when you see sort of a mechanical toy that walks or waves or wags a tail. When you take it apart and you see inside kind of all the gears and motors and the way they move, it's pretty interesting. It's a big kind of almost conceptual pause. You see this thing from the outside, carefully cut it open, and then see what's actually causing that movement. It's pretty cool.
Mm. Before we get into the book, I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, combining the word tinkering with curiosity and creativity and things like that. And I'm wondering if our consumer culture of recent years, decades perhaps, if it has dampened our curiosity. And I want to ask you about some of these summer camps that I have sent my kids to where you bring your appliance, but it seems like you have to go about retraining our whole psyche to create curiosity first before you take the appliance apart.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. I think we, those C words are often ones you don't hear a lot in education. They don't seem like, well, the curiosity and creativity part is not really something that we hear much about in school. So unless parents or individuals are cultivating it for themselves, we do kind of train it out of ourselves almost, because we see tinkering as a practice. It's something that, you know, the more you do it, the better you get. We call it a tinkerer's disposition. Hmm. And you're absolutely right about going into camps or classes, you know, you have to start somewhere. Everybody does. And we really like to get people started with what personally resonates with them. That's why the Tinkering Studio here at the Exploratorium has so many different aspects of kind of whatever the science or technology is that we're exploring.
But putting tinkering, the type of tinkering at the at your site in San Francisco, just putting that off to the side for a second, the whole do-it-yourself revolution with the store Michaels, the people that want to build their own wreaths or they want to do these different hobbying type things, hobby shops, Home Depot. People like to work with their hands, and people get a lot of satisfaction from that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we place a high value on the handmade, and even take it a step further in saying there's this phrase that was coined by a mentor of mine that taught at MIT for many years, Seymour Papert. He talks about constructionism, that you, as you construct something, something else is going on in your mind, and it's kind of a more durable knowledge and understanding when you are actually physically manipulating a tangible thing. And I think the consumer, you know, the Michaels is a good example. It's access to kind of materials and stuff to get people started. But what goes along with that is the whole community. Once you start looking, that was the best thing about the book. Once you start looking, there are so many people kind of doing interesting things in similar genres that you feel like, hey, I'm not alone in this. You know, for me personally, it was like, there are other weirdos out there that I can relate to that really enjoy kind of geeking out with some of this stuff.
But when you do these projects, you feel really good after they're completed. I mean, when you're a kid, you're getting strokes all the time. And as you get older and older, you know, people don't say to you, hey, great job. Wow, that was awesome. And you do these little projects and you sit back, you take a look at it and you say, man, I did that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, well, this is another area where I think technology helps. One of my favorite examples is Maker Faire or a mini Maker Faire. That's a physical connection with people. But the web has really allowed us to share and document work in ways mm-hmm. that we haven't before. So people can identify or see what you're doing and really value it, and they're, you know, they're pretty far away. But it actually is really gratifying for the maker or the tinkerer to be able to share what they do as well.
Hmm.
And they're flattered that you bought their product. If you look at Etsy, and I've done business with different makers within Etsy, and every time I do, they send a handwritten note, thank you so much for buying my product. I'm so glad. I hope you like it. Call me if you have any questions. So they really take a, you know, they have a lot of pride.
Yeah, it's a total win-win. I feel the same way with Etsy. And I think, you know, there are a lot of folks in the book that are on Etsy, but one of my favorite examples that I just have to mention since you brought it up is Emily Stoneking. She, her store on Etsy is called Anitomy, so think anatomy, but the word knit is inserted. And she knits these three-dimensional sculptures. So taking a technique that she learned in making a sock, she's now turned it in a way to kind of make three-dimensional things. And she makes dissected rats, frogs, worms, and sells them like complete in a dissection tray. So I'm actually looking at my rat right now, sitting on my desk. And, you know, it's one of those weird mashups. It's, is it art? Is it science? What is it? It's this subversive, kind of humorous take that is unique that I certainly appreciated because I bought one.
Yes, you must have. So as you two are sitting here talking about Etsy, I have to admit that Etsy, mm-hmm. I did not know what it was until last weekend. I was sitting in a bar in a ski resort in Jackson, Wyoming, next to two Vermonters, of course. And isn't that where Etsy got its start? Is in Vermont, because it's such a state of do it yourself and make cool things. And yeah, so maybe we should say what it is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't realize Etsy started there. Emily is actually from Vermont. But yeah, so Etsy is this incredible platform that has come about for makers to post. So you create a little storefront and you can put pictures of what you do and then you can sell things. So it's a commerce site, really, but it's also a way to just connect with artists and makers in a terrific way, just as you mentioned, you know, that they do. Every time you get handwritten notes. Emily's actually come out to San Francisco now to visit and looked me up and came to the museum.
Oh,
so, I mean,
that
was across the country.
I hope she doesn't attempt to visit every one of her customers, but it's a good story. So I wanted to ask you, Karen, about, let's talk about the book a little bit. And first of all, we're very bummed that we don't have a copy of it sitting in front of us, but we do know about it. And we know that there is conductive ink, as in it conducts electricity, on the cover of the book. And there's this great YouTube, about a minute and a half, little video of how it does that. So talk about that.
Yeah, so I apologize for you not having a book. I want to get a book in your hands right away because it's too much fun to play with the ink. So when we first started thinking about the book, we wanted you to be able to tinker with it. So we kind of tried to come up with all sorts of ideas, and this is the one that seemed to stick. We wanted to find out a way to print this conductive ink that we had heard about on the cover. So what you can do is take a 9-volt battery, you push it down onto the ink, and it essentially will complete the circuit. But the cool thing is, if you did it with just the battery, I don't know that it would short circuit because ink is resistant. But what you can do is put down an LED in the pack as well, and you can light an LED. And I think now, since we've been prototyping it, and now that it's officially out, I've probably done it 1,000 times. I get excited every time it lights up.
Well, prototyping, now that you brought that up, that is one of your tenets of tinkering. Can you talk about the basic moving pieces that go into tinkering?
Yeah, I think for prototyping, it's probably, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways, I've grown up at the Exploratorium. I've been here for 15 years now. But one of the things that I appreciate so much is this idea of prototyping, to try something out, get an idea, bring it into physical reality fast, so you here, you know, we share it with others in terms of things out on the floor. But then the best thing about prototyping is that you don't get attached to an idea, so it's so precious that you don't want to tweak it again, because the part of tinkering that is so valuable is this tweaking or iterating, because then the more people you get involved, the better your idea gets, or the more you work with it and tweak it, the more fluent you become in that process. And whether it's the project you're working on now or the next one you're going to undertake, all of those are skills that you're building as you, you know, as you move through this stuff.
So you have an idea, and it's really important to get it out of your brain as quick as you can, to sketch it, to begin building a model, to knock it around with other people, knock around ideas. I've got that. Tell me about other tenets of tinkering.
Well, that one, let me just say, that one is a really big one. I think, especially as adults, we question ourselves or think, oh, no, that idea is silly, and then we drop it. And I would really say not to drop it. Really encourage yourself to try as much as you can to not censor yourself. Other tenets are things like, one of my favorite ones is kind of has to do with material exploration, and it's kind of appreciating the familiar things used in unfamiliar ways, whether it's, most often that's a material, but even tools. The one I'm thinking about, there's an artist who does extraordinary things with toothpicks in the book, and he's one of my favorite examples because he happens to be a produce manager at the grocery store near my house, and I saw him walking across the parking lot with a toothpick hat on his head. And my radar now is pretty attuned to tinkerers and makers, but, you know, that one was pretty obvious.
His structure is huge. I saw it in the book off of the Amazon, you know, look at the pages now. And that's a pretty big structure, and he keeps adding to it.
The amazing thing, he started it when he was 14. He's been doing it for 38 years. So it was taking up a space in his living room. It's here at the museum now, but his wife is so glad. but it was 9 feet tall and 9 feet wide. But not only is it a sculpture with recognizable parts of San Francisco, you drop ping pong balls in different locations, and it's a ball run. So there are seven different, quote-unquote, tours of Francisco that you get to take through this toothpick creation.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. So you feature about 150 tinkerers in the book, and how many of those have projects that are at the Exploratorium currently, or do you just kind of, is it an evolving, revolving door of tinker projects?
Well, we love to have artists and scientists come in with us. So the main features in the book have all been folks who have worked with us here. But the idea is there throughout that book, there are people who do it for a living, and there are novices who literally just got started. And that kind of mix is something that we really appreciate. This isn't for the professionals. This is for everyone.
That's so great. And it's pretty interesting on your website to look through some of the descriptions of the artists or the tinkerers. And like this one, for example, Danny Scheibel. He was first attracted to masking tape because of its versatile, accessible, and malleable nature. So he has created large-scale installations out of masking tape that redefine the potential of the medium. I didn't know masking tape was actually considered an art medium, but I love it.
Yeah, he's another one. You know, every single one of these tinkerers, I just absolutely adore. So Danny, he's developed this technique that he calls tape-agami, but it's flipping masking tape back over on itself, and then he rolls it into these tubes. He shaves one arm, so there's no hair on one arm, and he rolls it up his arm, and then that's the basis for all of these things. But he's made gigantic things, whole rooms that are filled with masking tape, big lights and lamps that are all tape. They're pretty great.
Yeah. We're running out of time, Karen, but if you could just tell us, what are the top five tools that you need for tinkering? We have people listening right now who are quickly prototyping. We need to tell them what tools to use.
Well, so I'm totally biased. You'd ask somebody else here, and they'd give you five different ones. But for me, it's a Weller soldering iron, but that's an expensive soldering iron, so you may not want to start there. A wire stripper of a certain kind. Your hands, I would say, is a biggie. Sharpies, tools to kind of write with, and a good utility knife.
Okay.
Well, Karen, we want to thank you very much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio. Karen Wilkinson, co-author of the book, The Art of Tinkering.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. I want to give everybody an update. Interstate 80 is clear, and that is an update from 9:55, just a couple of minutes old. We'll return after these messages.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
One day it's sunny, next day it's snowing.
Then it's rainy, now it's clear.
It just doesn't know what to do.
No pressure, whatever the weather does.
Our forecast is for fun. The hot things to do and the cool places to be.
Get the inside scoop from your outside-the-box hosts, John and Jan, on Fun Friday.
Thanks to our all-weather sponsors.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
Foothill Oriental Rugs.
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery. Please, consult your meteorologist. Listening may cause laughter.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio today. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells, and want to thank both of our guests, Navina Sadazavam. I said that name three times correctly while we were speaking to her. This is a good thing because I'm sure it gets mispronounced.
I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah, a reporter at ProPublica, and very interesting. I might say go ahead and look up ProPublica.com. Lots of interesting investigative reporting. Also, thanks to Karen Wilkinson, co-author of The Art of Tinkering.
Of course, we want to thank our underwriters, Peak Art and Frame, San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and, of course, our producer extraordinaire, Beth Fratkin. Also, join us tomorrow for Fun Friday. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Please tune in to Cool Science Radio next Thursday. Same time, same channel.